This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, we're going to be talking about the wide world of ice here on Earth and beyond. But first, this week, the House Science Committee promoted a story that claimed NOAA scientists had manipulated climate data in a recent scientific report. But, well, as is the case with a lot of what's in the news today, that's not what really happened. Here to unpack the tale and other selected short subjects in science is Rachel Feltman, science editor at Popular Science Magazine. Welcome back, Rachel.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
So what is the paper that the committee is all worked up about?
Yeah, so this is a very famous study from 2015 called the Carl Study. And it deals with this question of whether or not there was a climate change hiatus. Now, the scientific consensus is that human activity has contributed to global warming, climate change. And for a while, it looked in the data like that climate change had slowed down at some point. There had been some kind of cooling period, if you will. And in 2015, the Carl Study reevaluated a bunch of data. Basically, NOAA had changed the way they were getting data. And once you kind of ironed all that out, it became clear that the hiatus had not occurred. Now, what happened is that a former NOAA employee named John Bates has started to complain that he doesn't agree with the way all of the data in the Carl Study was handled. What the House Science Committee did was write a press release based on a Daily Mail article, which is a British tabloid of fairly ill repute, if you're not familiar. The House Science Committee, which is tasked with overseeing all of our scientific institutions, and their press release implied that Bates' whistleblowing meant that the hiatus had occurred, that scientists had falsified data. And what's really crazy here is that even if you believe Bates, what he's saying has nothing to do with the hiatus. He's saying he doesn't agree with the way the Carl Study handled land temperature data, but the hiatus was based on sea surface temperature data. So it's just incredibly misleading, and it's very troubling that this was put up on the House Science Committee website.
You're trying to confuse the issue with the evidence here, bringing real evidence to this. You're never going to make it in the news if you keep doing that. Let's move on. In other news this week, there's new findings about a possible male contraceptive. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so 45% of pregnancies in the U.S. are still accidental, which is kind of crazy. And an area where that could really be improved is male birth control. Right now, men really only have condoms as an option, and they fail a lot. Apparently, 15% of men actually, remove condoms before sex is over, which, the guys, that's not how condoms work. Please keep them on.
And get the memo.
Yeah. So this product called Vasogel has been very exciting as a male birth control. It's basically a gel that is injected. It blocks sperm from moving through the vas deferens, and then it can be removed very easily. So it's kind of like a reversible vasectomy. And this new study, 16 young male monkeys had the procedure and then were allowed to live with fertile females for 1 to 2 years, and there were no pregnancies. There were a couple of complications, but female birth control has a lot of side effects. So, yeah. If men want Vasogel, they're probably going to have to accept it with some low rates of troublesome side effects. So it was a pretty promising study, and hopefully we'll move to human trials at some point.
Is this an injection? Is it a cream or what?
Yeah, so it's an injection of a gel, and then in theory it lasts as long as you want it to. And then you get a second injection that causes the gel to break up, and it just kind of gets reabsorbed by your body. So again, it acts just like a vasectomy, but the mechanical block is temporary.
You have a story about the genome of a grain. Tell us about this. This is a grain, everybody. So it's like the grain of choice now.
Yeah. Quinoa, because of its really relatively high protein content compared to rice and barley, is considered kind of a superfood, but it's also really a specialty item because it's almost exclusively grown on these small farms, and it's only a staple crop in South America where it's grown by hand. It's this very tall, fragile stalk, so it's difficult to really scale up. So by sequencing the quinoa genome, researchers hope that they can figure out better ways of doing, targeted crossbreeding to make it kind of shorter and sturdier so that it can be grown on a larger scale. Now, quinoa, even though it's physically fragile, it's actually quite resilient. It can grow in very salty soil with salty irrigation water. So on the other hand, they hope that looking at the genome can help them figure out how to make other crops like rice and barley more resilient. So, you know, we're going to be able to grow more quinoa and we're going to be able to use its secrets to grow crops in less ideal soil.
So why does everybody, you know, look toward quinoa? What's the it's basically better because?
It compared to rice and barley, it has a really high protein content and some other, nice nutritional value. It's
gluten-free, right?
Yeah, I believe so. And it's still just a plant that you can eat, but, it has some attractive nutritional properties. Yeah. And it tastes good, too, I guess.
Yeah, it's pretty good. and lastly, you have a story about an unusual new species of gecko.
Yes.
Something special about this gecko?
Yeah, something really horribly special about it. So the fish scale gecko genus is known for having tearaway skin, which is what it sounds like. If a predator grabs one of these geckos, they just leave their skin behind to escape. And it's not like the way a snake sheds its skin where it only does it once there's healthy skin underneath. The gecko is like they look like raw chicken. It's terrible. But it's better than getting eaten. And scientists found this new species, Gecgalopus megalopus. So it's got the largest scales and they're also the most fragile. So even handling it in the lab, the geckos that they found lost most of their scales. So they actually had to do CT scans of them so that they could look at their skeletal structure, because otherwise they didn't feel like they would be able to define the species well enough, because they couldn't take a good look at it. They're really interested in how they're able to survive so well with this very raw skin, and their scales grow back very quickly over the course of a couple weeks. So there's a lot of interest in terms of, looking at possible medical applications for burn victims. But they're really hard to study because of how hard they are to catch. So it's hard to say when we'll actually be able to find something useful there.
Yeah, well, we'll have you back when they do, actually.
Okay.
Thank you, Rachel. Rachel Feltman, science editor at Popular Science Magazine. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Now, we often discuss on this program how automation, robots are taking over our jobs. It's a growing concern in many sectors, including science publishing. Publishers are increasingly experimenting with artificial intelligence to review scientific papers. But how much do we want algorithms evaluating our research instead of people doing that, people determining what gets published and what doesn't? With me to discuss the good and bad of AI-assisted peer review is Adam Marcus, co-founder of the blog Retraction Watch, managing editor of Gastroenterology and Endoscopy News. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Let's talk about peer review. Why is peer review so important?
Two words, Ira. Fake news. Peer review is science's version of a filter for fake news. It's the way that journals try to weed out studies that might not be methodologically sound, or they might have results that could be explained by hypotheses other than what the researchers advanced. And it's this system that they have of screening manuscripts before they get published.
Mm-hmm. Now, there has been a lot written about whether artificial intelligence will play a big role in this process. What could an algorithm do better than maybe a person can?
Well, the way we see it, algorithms can do nothing necessarily better, except they can do it faster and in bulk. So I can give you an example. There's a system called StatCheck, which was developed by researchers in the Netherlands, which is able to rapidly detect potential errors in statistical values. They can do, according to the researchers, in a nanosecond what a person might take 10 minutes to do. So obviously that could be very important for analyzing vast numbers of papers. But the problem is that it catches signals, and there's a lot of noise in those signals. And so what really you need is the human component to make sure that what is being detected on a first pass is actually a real red flag.
Mm-hmm. So could there possibly be a hybrid of AI and people together?
Absolutely. In fact, I think that's how the system probably should work going forward. Here's another example. Many publishers, in fact, every reputable publisher should be using right now plagiarism detection software to analyze manuscripts that get submitted. At their most effective, these identify passages in papers that have similarity with previously published passages, but it should be up to a human editor to figure out whether that's, in fact, plagiarism or there's a good reason for something to be overlapping.
Mm-hmm. If you use an algorithm, is there not the possibility, and now this is sort of true of everything that has to do with computers these days, of the program being hacked?
Well, I'm not an expert in hacking. I'm sure that anything's possible, but it's also true that there are ways to hack the programs that we have now. I mean, you can be pretty sophisticated at writing papers so that you take a little bit from many papers, and a plagiarism detection scan won't detect plagiarism.
Mm-hmm. So the best practice is, where do you think this will shake out? What will happen here, do you think?
I think I'd like to see that every manuscript that gets submitted be run through a plagiarism detection software system, a robust image detection software system. In other words, something that looks for duplicated images or fabricated images. And these things are in the works. In fact, there's a researcher at Stanford, Elizabeth Bick, who did a study recently which found, and this was I, not AI, it was just human intelligence, and she analyzed about 20,000 papers and found that about 1 in 25 had improperly duplicated images. And then we have some sort of StatCheck-like program that looks for squishy data.
Okay, so you think all of that will be combined and we'll automate this a little bit more but still have the human element involved. Anna Marcus, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure.
Anna Marcus, co-founder of the blog Retraction Watch, managing editor of Gastroenterology and Endoscopy News. Say that quickly. After the break, if it's not cold enough for you yet, we aim to fix that. We're going to be touring the weird and wonderful ice of our polar ice caps and venture out into the far reaches of our solar system for cryovolcanoes. Say that three times. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're going to be talking now about frazzle ice, that is. That's not ice that's extremely stressed or harried. No, it's just one of many kinds of ice you might find forming in the seas at our poles. There's also pancake ice, sugar ice, ridge ice, grease ice. I could keep going on, but we'll talk more about it. Mariners and scientists that spend time in the sea ice, they have more than two dozen names for the types that they see. Since the groundhog predicted another six weeks of winter for us, even as global ice cover hits a record low this January, we thought we'd celebrate a bit with a tour of the unique features of our polar ice first. We'll be touring all over our galaxy, so let's talk about our polar ice right here at home. Ted Maxim is associate scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
I have to tighten up my mouth here a little bit. You're packing for a trip to Antarctica, even as we speak, where there's a lot of ice?
Yes, I am. We're going down to Antarctica this Australwinter, so it's sort of our summer. It's actually April and May, and trying to get as deep into the ice pack as we can. To see what's going on there.
So that's going via an icebreaker then?
It's going via an icebreaker, yeah. And going through sea ice, so it's not through big glaciers. That would be impossible. The sea ice is down there is usually only a few feet thick. So you got a strong enough ship, you can get through pretty well.
So is it still dark down there? Is it going to be getting dark soon? I should say it's austral.
Right. So it's the opposite of us, right? So it's quite light down there. By the time we get down there, which is going to be mid-April, it's going to be starting to get dark. And we plan to get as far south as you possibly can at sea on this planet, which is about 78 degrees south. By the time we get there in mid-May, it's going to be 24 hours of darkness.
And it's not scary to be in the ocean surrounded by all that sea ice?
It's not scary. I mean, you get used to work.
In the dark?
Like an ice fisherman. You know, he's comfortable walking on ice in Minnesota. We get used to it. It's not really that scary at all. But it's certainly an eerie feeling. It's sort of a very odd landscape and in the darkness, it adds an extra element to it.
I'll bet it does. Having been down there in the summertime, I can only imagine what wintering over must be like or in the dark. Let's talk about some of the ice that's down there. This thing I mentioned, Frazzle ice. What is that?
Yeah, so frazzle ice is really just a term for loose crystals of ice. It can be in the ocean or it could be in a river. It's kind of like a little bit like a snowflake in the water, I guess. And that forms because the water is turbulent, and you get lots of this in Antarctica, because if you know your geography in Antarctica, it's surrounded by the stormiest ocean on the planet, more or less. And so you have these big waves traveling through it. So it's really hard to form a solid sheet of ice, as you can imagine. So it has to form loose crystals for it first. This forms a soupy mass of frazzle crystals, and eventually they start to agglomerate together as it damps out the waves.
Mm-hmm. And we have all kinds of ice. I mentioned there were a dozen. What is pancake ice?
So pancake is the next stage of ice. So as you get a lot of this frazzle in the ocean, it looks kind of like a soupy mass of slush. Now, what that does, it sort of damps down the waves a little bit. And as it does that, things can start freezing together. But, you know, the waves are really big there, so it's hard to damp them down right away. So these soupy masses sort of stick together and bang against each other. And so you get these tiny little pans, well, you know, tiny, maybe 3 to 10 feet across, that are just banging into each other like a bunch of pucks on an air hockey table, if you will. And they form these round shapes that, you know, people thought looked like pancakes, but they got kind of rough edges because they're always crashing into each other.
Yeah, we have photos of these ices on our website. They are amazing. They do look like I was waiting for the maple syrup to come out. And then you have ridges and nylas and sugar. Tell us about these.
Right. So, yeah, kind of like Eskimos with all their words for snow. It's because things take different forms. You want to be able to describe it in a concise way. So sugar is actually a kind of ice you don't see very often. It's when the frazzle kind of gloms together in like almost like snowballs floating around in the ocean. Nylas is sort of the opposite of frazzle ice. It's when you have fresh ice forming. And I think everybody who's been in cold weather is familiar with this. You see it as a very thin veneer of ice on top of a lake. On the sea ice, on the ocean, it looks a little bit different because that is a little bit salty. So it tends not to be as clear as it would on the on a lake. So that has to form. You can imagine you need really calm conditions for that.
Yeah.
No waves. So that forms sort of in the interior of the pack. Once you've got pack ice, if you've got any cracks or openings, nylas can form in there. And that's quite thin. And then it starts to thicken because it's Antarctica. It's really cold. And as the ice continues to move around, that can sort of pile up as big plates of ice crash together. Plates we call them ice floes, crash together. And bits break off and sort of pile up into these big sort of walls of ice, if you will, that can be many feet thick. In the Arctic, you get, because the forces are so large there, you can get ice piled up to tens of feet thick.
Well, you know, I remember when I was in Antarctica, right on the shoreline of McMurdo there, it was some of the most beautiful stuff I'd ever seen, was the sea ice piling up, you know, changing shape, forming caves. It was just beautiful. I can imagine, you know, why you'd want to go.
Yeah, and that's something, you know, when we go south, we're sitting on these icebreakers and we're always getting off on the ice and doing our measurements and we're busy with our science. But to me, you know, one of the most enjoyable things is just sitting on the bridge of the ship, just watching for hours as you're going through different types of ice or different formations of ice. It's always constantly changing. It's not, you know, I don't want to say it's boring on a lake, but it's pretty uniform on a lake most of the time. The Great Lakes are a little bit more interesting, I suppose. But, you know, somewhere like Antarctica or the Arctic, you have this constantly changing landscape. But it's all ice.
We've had people on Twitter asking us about the brinicles. icy fingers of death. There's a wonderful YouTube video on this that looks just like it's CGI. It's so spooky looking. But have you ever seen one? Tell us, describe what's going on there.
Yeah. So this is an interesting thing about ice. Or sea ice. It's not like other types of ice in that it's a composite material, because the ocean is salt water, of course, but it's hard to freeze that salt into the ice. So what it does is it traps salt in little pockets of brine in the ice, and that really determines the properties of that ice. Now, when you get the salt trapped in there, it doesn't like staying in there, so it tries to drain out through this porous network. Within the ice, there's all these little channels of brine. And so when you get ice thick enough and the salt starts draining out, it sort of drains out kind of like in a little river going down vertically. Now, in Antarctica, sometimes, like you mentioned McMurdo Sound area, you can get these sort of rivers of brine coming down into water that's at the freezing point, but that brine is much colder. So as soon as it hits that water, it freezes. So it starts forming this kind of icicle going down into the ocean below, except it's hollow, so it can have this brine coming out down through this tube. And some of these tubes can be many feet long. And then that video is kind of cool, you had this drainage happen very rapidly. And when that brine hit the bottom of the ocean, that is what it's in a state we call supercooled. So it's actually colder than the freezing point. As soon as it hits something where it can start nucleating ice, it starts to freeze. And you saw that spread along the ocean bottom. It was really cool because you saw all these sea stars trying to run away from this, but then get trapped in the ice.
Right. It's a great little video. It's great to see that. How you mentioned the Antarctic oceans. How are the oceans different? How is the ice in Antarctica different from the Arctic ice up north?
Right. Well, I should say that they used to be quite different. They're getting more and more alike. In the Arctic, the ice, because the Arctic is sort of this enclosed basin, the ice doesn't escape the Arctic Ocean very easily. So it can circulate there, because the ice drifts around, it can circulate there for many years and get thicker and thicker. So you have ice there that used to average maybe 10 feet thick. And it can get quite thick because the ocean doesn't have, the deep ocean, the heat has trouble getting up to the ice and melting it. In the Antarctic, things are very different. It's a wide open sea that it's exposed to. So it's always buffeted by the waves. And deep beneath the surface of the ocean, there's actually some really warm water that gets stirred up really easily. And that keeps the ice very thin. So actually, most ice, unless it's ridged, rarely gets more than a few feet thick in the Antarctic, which is convenient for those of us who want to drive our icebreaker through there.
Yeah.
But it makes it for a very different environment. The Arctic has this thick ice with big, thick ridges. The Antarctic has thin ice with more pancake ice, and things are moving around much more rapidly. But that's all sort of changing a little bit because we've seen over the past decade that in the summer in the Arctic, almost half of the ice has been disappearing. We're getting about half of what we used to have, say, back in the 1980s. So the Antarctic is sort of an interesting analog for what we might expect to see in the Arctic. And actually, about a year and a half ago, we were up there and we saw this extensive fields of frazzle and pancake ice that really haven't been seen in the high Arctic before.
Wow, things are changing. I want to add to the conversation someone who has seen the poles with an artist's eye, where we're talking about how beautiful the ice is. Michael Carroll is an astronomical artist based in Littleton, Colorado. His work often tries to imagine the surface of distant worlds, and he has spent 3 weeks in December exploring Antarctica, looking for inspiration for the surface of the icy moons of Europa. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, Ira, I love your show, and it's great to be here. Thanks.
Well, thank you. We're very happy to have you. Why is Antarctica such a good place to look for inspiration for a moon of Jupiter or Saturn?
Well, for some of the same things that your other guests have been talking about, it's unique in so many ways, the way the ice behaves down there. Of course, in the outer solar system, a lot of these moons are our ice world. Europa has an ocean probably 100 kilometers deep beneath an ice crust. And on that crust, you see these pressure ridges and things that are somewhat similar to what we see down in Antarctica on the open sea ice right there next to the Ross Ice Shelf. But more than that, there are some fairly specific analogs we were looking at up on Mount Erebus on the big volcano down there.
Really? Such as what?
Well, so Erebus has these fumaroles, these volcanic vents all over its slopes. And so the hot air comes up through these things. It hits this frigid air up above, and it forms columns of ice. And these towers of ice are just the most bizarre things. They are beautiful and inspiring. The blues, the textures in them, some of these things are five stories tall, and they look like a nightmare from Salvador Dali's diary. You know, they're just the most bizarre things. But because you get this constant flow building these structures, we think that things similar to that may happen on, for example, Saturn's moon Enceladus.
Wow. Ted, do you think that, let me first tell everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about ice and at the poles, and now we're moving out into space. Ted, could a place like Antarctica help scientists somehow plan for a mission to icy moons?
Yeah, definitely. And there are scientists doing specifically that. One of the interesting things in sea ice, like I said, there's this brine, liquid brine in the ice. What that has in it is these organisms that can tolerate extreme cold. And so people are interested in looking at sea ice as an analog for what kind of habitats you might possibly have on a moon like Europa. But Antarctica is also a really nice proving ground for vehicles that you might design to explore a moon like Europa. And so there are a couple of groups that are trying to develop vehicles, sort of prototype vehicles that might go up to Europa and putting them under these ice shelf to see how you can technologically achieve getting down through many kilometers of ice down to some unknown ocean.
Michael Carroll, when you look at a place on Earth like this, how do you account for how a moon or another planet might look differently?
Well, the main difference is, of course, air. We've got lots of nice air to breathe here on Earth, although up on Mount Erebus there isn't that much. But when you're dealing with a vacuum, these towers that build may take on some different textures and forms, because on Antarctica they're sculpted by wind. But nevertheless, we do think that there are some fascinating structures out there, and for an astronomical artist, we try to learn from nature to inform us for those guesses that we're making in terms of the geology on other worlds.
Because you have such a good eye as an artist, do the scientists come to you and say, hey, have you seen anything that we have missed, perhaps?
Well, it's always a wonderful collaboration. My colleague that I traveled to Antarctica with, Rosalie Lopez, who has been on your show, by the way, she is often talking to me about how things would look because she doesn't think in those terms. And so she'll give me some numbers, and I take those and translate them into something visual that the non-scientist can understand, relate to.
Well, we're gonna have Rosalie join us right after the break, and we have to say goodbye to both of you because we are running out of time. Fascinating. Ted Maxim is associate scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Woods Hole. Michael Carroll is an astronomical artist based in Littleton, Colorado. And we have actually up on our website some of your artwork at sciencefriday.com/space art. So it's really, really interesting stuff that you're doing. And thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Have a great weekend.
Hey, thanks, Ira.
Thank you.
You're welcome. As I said, we're going to take a break. When we come back, one last chilly adventure, the icy cryovolcanoes. Cryo, you know what that cryovolcanoes, put them together, and where are they? That's right, they're outside in our solar system. Go to the head of the class. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you just joined us, we were just marveling at the ice at the Earth's poles, and it certainly is beautiful and it is interesting. But we're not quite done with ice yet, because as it's certainly not as unusual as the icy phenomenon at work in the far reaches of our solar system. And I'm talking about the cryovolcano. It is like a volcano, but instead of hot magma, you have this frigid slush bursting through an icy crust. Cryovolcanoes have been suspected on the icy moons of Saturn and Jupiter, like Enceladus and Titan, and even dwarf planet Pluto may have some. My guest, Rosalie Lopez, a volcanologist and manager of planetary sciences at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, knows a lot about this. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, hello. Hello. It's nice to be back.
Nice to have you back. How are ice volcanoes possible? What's going on inside there?
Well, they're very weird. We didn't even think that they were possible until we actually saw evidence, because there is nothing like them on Earth. But when the Voyager spacecraft flew by Neptune in 1989, it actually saw some 8-kilometer-high plumes and also some very smooth regions that people figured out had to be caused by volcanism. But not rock volcanism or magma volcanism like we see on Earth, but a very special kind of volcanism that we call cryovolcanism.
Does the science of these ordinary volcanoes translate easily to cryovolcanoes, or are they just different in how they behave?
Not easily, no, and we're still figuring that out. Essentially on a cryovolcano, it happens when you have an icy crust, like on Jupiter's moon Europa or Saturn's moon Enceladus or Titan, and underneath that icy crust, you have an ocean of liquid water, maybe liquid water with things like methane or ammonia. And so volcanism, we actually had to redefine what volcanism is, because volcanism used to be defined as the process that brings molten rock from the interior of a body to the surface. But now we had to redefine it and say it brings magma, whatever the magma is for that specific body. So if the magma is water or slushy ice, that's what that volcanism on that body will bring up.
So you've actually had to also redefine what magma is.
Yes, exactly. It's magma on an icy moon or on Pluto. It's different. It's not molten rock like on Earth or on Venus or on Mars. And when we study volcanoes on Mars, for example, which I have done, we can use Earth analogs quite easily. You can go to Hawaii or Iceland, places, right, for example, that have shield volcanoes. But when you're studying cryovolcanism, there are no cryovolcanoes on Earth. So that's what makes figuring out the process difficult.
So you know, as you say, on Earth, it's this hot magma that comes shooting up. We can imagine why it would do that. It's hot. It's coming out of the, you know, underneath the ground. What is driving the slushy water up through a volcano?
Well, that's what is difficult to figure out, because, if you think about just having a glass of water and ice cubes on top, ice cubes float.
Mm-hmm.
So the difficulty is how do we get around that density difference that the ice will want to be on top of the water? So how do you actually get the water up to erupt? And there are various theoretical explanations. You could get maybe part of that ice shell melting because of tidal heating, and then they could make close reservoirs of magma closer to the surface. You might get fractures, like giant crevasses opening up, and maybe that cryomagma has a lot of bubbles that would make it easier to come up. Maybe even that ice shell is not completely ice, but it might have some silicates in it. There are a lot of things that we don't know yet.
I have a tweet coming in from Randy LaMonda says, could a solar refrigerator suck in salt water during the could you send somebody there to the space, you know, a mission and investigate, and should that be part of any mission to these moons of Jupiter or Saturn?
Oh, I think it's very important to investigate cryovolcanism, because if you have heat and you have water, those are two of the conditions that you need for life. So if you're going to look for life and these icy moons of the outer solar system, the presence or absence of cryovolcanism is very important. And, you know, if I sent a lander to one of these worlds, I would definitely want to land, near a cryovolcano. And NASA just released a report on a study of a lander to Jupiter's moon Europa. So maybe we're going to get there with a lander.
Yes,
we need more missions.
Would this tell you, do these volcanoes speak anything about the possibility of any forms of life on any of these moons?
Yes, because you need, as I said, heat. And you need water. Those are not the only two things that you need for life, of course. And, you know, astrobiologists are still arguing about what are all the conditions that you need. But you certainly need those two. So the, you know, places maybe near the surface where you actually have pockets of this molten ice or water would be a good place to sample. Yeah. To see if we actually have any kind of microbes there.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, many Antarctica studies, some astrobiologists are going to Antarctica to actually study what kind of microorganisms we find there.
I have to ask you a question akin to asking which child you like best. You study both hot and cold volcanoes.
Yes.
Do you have a favorite? Just between you and me.
Okay, I actually like, maybe I like hot volcanoes better because I can actually go to them.
Good point. And then you can go home again, as they say.
That's right, yes. But I did go to Erebus, which is not a cryovolcano, but it was very, very cold. And
yeah.
Michael Carr and I went to Erebus in December, which was a fantastic trip.
Yeah, I was there. I was there over 30 years ago myself. It really was a fantastic experience. Dr. Lopez, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, thank you so much.
And we'll have you back when, you know, you'll tell us more about these volcanoes. Rosalie Lopez is a volcanologist and manager of planetary sciences at NASA's JPL in Pasadena, California. Next up, you may have read the news recently that you and I, we're living in a giant hologram, that the universe, it's just an illusion. Projected holographically from a two-dimensional reality. Mind-blowing stuff, right? Well, let's just say those reports may have gotten a little carried away with that sci-fi scenario. But there is some useful information here. Holographic cosmology is a real thing, and it is a way of simplifying the equations, a different way to push the numbers around. And my next guest is one of the lucky cosmologists who gets to do that math. Nayesh Ashorty is an associate professor. Ashorty is associate professor at the University of Waterloo, and the Perimeter Institute in Ontario, Canada. He and his team wrote about their models in the journal Physical Review Letters. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Ashorty.
Thank you, Ira. Good to be with you.
It's good. It's good to have you. You know, are all of those stories about we live in a holographic universe really just going a little bit too far?
Maybe not. Depends on how your imagination, how imaginative you are. I guess that's the way to put it.
What do you mean?
So that's good. I think there is a lot of it that's imagination and fiction, but there is some truth into it, and that's actually something that physicists have been thinking about for the past 20 years, if not longer. And that goes back to one of the deepest mysteries in science, that how do quantum mechanics and gravity work together? And that's the mystery that has been with us since Einstein, basically, since Einstein discovered relativity and others discovered quantum mechanics. We never really know, never really learned how they talk to each other, and that's it's been 100 years since then. So the holography is this new language we learned in the past 20 years or so, that maybe there's a way for these two to talk to each other, but for that you have to lower the number of dimensions.
So, yes, you have to either take out what, time or...
Good. So you could take one dimension, you could take out one dimension of a space, or you can take out time, and really depends on the situation, what makes the calculations easier. So what we have looked at with our collaborators and my student Beth, we looked at how this thing works out during the Big Bang. Big Bang is one of those places where universe is very complicated. Because that's one of those places where everything becomes very massive, but also very small, so that you need to use both gravity and quantum mechanics. And we think holography can be actually applied there, and we can understand what's happening during Big Bang.
So if you take out some of those dimensions and you apply holography, do you arrive at any new insights into the nature of the Big Bang? And what it was, what happened, that sort of stuff.
That's our proposal. So if you looked around yourself right now, it looks like there are three dimensions, and everything seems consistent with that notion of three dimensions. There is time, that's one dimension, and there are three spatial dimensions. You can go back and forth, you can go left and right, and you could go up and down, or jump up and down, if you will. If you go to earlier and earlier in time, so sometime around 14 billion years ago, we have lots of great data, observational data that tells us Big Bang or something like that happened. So universe was very hot, very dense, and everything was much smaller than we see today. And at that time, this notion of number of dimensions, three space in one time, looks like it doesn't work very well because quantum mechanics kind of doesn't talk to gravity. And it looks like if you take out one of those dimensions, like, for example, time, then it's much, much easier to understand what's going on. And what's amazing is that you can actually make predictions and fit the data, the observational data that come out of the Big Bang.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. So what you just said, what you were saying is that even if you take out some of the dimensions and then suddenly the data fits.
Suddenly the data fits.
Does that mean that you are better at is the standard model, you know, equally relevant to what you're saying, or one is better than the other?
Well, the problem is there is no standard model when it comes to conditions like that of the Big Bang. We have different ideas, different fictions, if you will, or different histories, different models for what might have happened. But we really don't have any way of testing them directly because we don't have time machine that could take any scientist back to the Big Bang. Even if we did have time machine, I don't think we wouldn't want to send a scientist back to such extreme conditions. It's probably much worse than the conditions you were talking about in your previous section. So that's why we cannot. We don't really know which of these stories or histories might be right. What we discovered is that there is actually a simple answer. If you just take out time or any dimension, then you can come up with a very simple model that fits all the data that we have.
But you're not quite ready to replace the standard model.
Yeah. Well, good. So the question is, what is a standard model good for? And a standard model is good for everything that we see around us. At that point, at the early times, then it's really the question of what will the preponderance of evidence point to? And right now, the standard model is roughly at the same point as the holographic picture is. But there will be much better data very, very soon, and hopefully we can pick which one is better.
Oh, so you're saying it all falls apart when we get that far back?
Absolutely.
And by using your method, you might and eliminating time or some of the dimensions, you might be able to probe that spot that no one really knows about. And I know that you spoke with one of my colleagues, and you didn't use the word history when we talked about it. You used the word history.
Well, I use the word a story, which is like what you tell your kids when you want them to go to bed. And I think that's the way I really think about this, is that history is something that kind of you're confident about. But the stories are like kind of things that might have some reality in them, but But you don't really know. And I think we have lots of those stories that we can tell our kids or tell other scientists about. But it's very hard to be sure of which story is the right one. And we are proposing that you just take out the story and just stick to the facts. And that's basically what holography is when it comes to the Big Bang.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the holographic math could bridge quantum mechanics and gravity, the two that are not bridgeable? Yeah,
that's the hope of this program, and we've been pushing this, and lots of other scientists have been pushing this. And what we're happy about is this is the first time we can actually connect this with real hard observations. But in the future, I think there will be much more progress, and hopefully by learning the language of holography better, we can say more about how quantum mechanics and gravity talk to each other.
So we're not actually living in a hologram.
Well, I think it's all in your mindset. I think if you feel happier living in a hologram, then all power to you.
Okay. That's the great quote of the weekend. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ashworth.
You're welcome. It was fun talking to you.
Yeah, Niyesh Afshorty is an associate professor at the University of Waterloo and Perimeter Institute up there in our friends in Ontario, Canada. One last thing before we go. If all this wintry weather's got you down, we've got just the thing. You can build a kite for spring. It's an activity from New Hampshire physics teacher and educator collaborator Susan Romano. So go to sciencefriday.com/kites to use physics to engineer the perfect kite. That's sciencefriday.com/kites. When you build them and spring comes around, and you'll be able to fly them. One last thing. Tonight, look skyward for a celestial trifecta. We have an eclipse of the moon, not a total eclipse, but it's still pretty good, a snow moon, and a comet all together tonight. Hope the weather holds up for all of us. Charles Berkowitz is our director, senior producer Christopher Talata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler. Luke Groskin is our video producer. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman, Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls. At the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. You want to email us? You can send us email scifry@sciencefriday.com or on Facebook and Twitter all week long. That's where you'll find us. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.